So this is then, as I indicated, our penultimate study in the life of Joseph, and our passage is Genesis 49, 28 through to 50, verse 21. And I would like us to consider this passage then this evening under two headings. And first of all, Joseph's father's funeral. Joseph's father's funeral. Because in the last verse of chapter 49, then, we have Jacob dying. We have, in that connection, this lovely phrase, which Moses uses several times in these first five books of the Bible that he wrote, when recording the death of a saint, he was gathered to his people. That can't refer simply to him being buried in the same place as his ancestors. Some commentators who don't like the idea that the Old Testament looks forward to life beyond the grave, they will say something like that, that a phrase like this, it's talking about Jacob being buried simply in the same place as his ancestors. And of course, Jacob was buried in the same place as his ancestors. He himself spells that out in this passage. But it's important to remember he wasn't buried there for quite some time, was he? The next verses, early part of chapter 50, will show us that following Jacob's death, 70 days went by before Joseph even asked Pharaoh permission to make that trip to Canaan for the burial of his father. Permission having been granted, we don't know how many days then elapsed before the journey to Canaan began. And the journey itself must have taken quite a while, and it included within it a 7-day stop at one point. So, as I say then, Jacob wasn't buried with his ancestors for quite some time, and yet we're clearly told here that upon breathing his last, he was gathered to his people. So this then has nothing to do with Jacob's bodily remains being laid in close proximity to the bodily remains of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah in some hole in the ground in Canaan. No, this is about Jacob's soul entering immediately into the presence of God and there experiencing real, conscious, joyful reunion with the souls of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah. That's what this phrase is talking about. And it reminds us of at least two things then. First of all, it reminds us that something happens to the believer as soon as he or she dies. Something happens to the believer as soon as he or she dies. As those of you who are regularly here will know, I'm always keen then to point you away really from the point of death and to direct your attention rather to the end of time and the appearing of Jesus Christ then, because I think that's where the biblical emphasis lies. The biblical emphasis doesn't lie on what happens at the believer's death. The biblical emphasis lies on what happens at the end of time. As we saw this morning, it's that second appearance of Christ that we Christians should be eagerly awaiting, not the temporary residence of our souls in heaven in between our death and that second appearing of Christ. Having said that, however, we mustn't overlook the fact that something does happen to the believer as soon as he or she dies. And although, yes, there is this provisionality about it because it's not the final glorified state that any believer enters into upon death, yet still it's a precious prospect nonetheless. You know Paul's words, "My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better." And he's talking there about his death. And he doesn't say then that will be the best possible state. Now, the best possible state will be being with Christ in our resurrected condition. But nonetheless, he says that being with Christ in that unresurrected condition, it's better. It's better than this that we experience right now. And so, as I say, we need to be aware of that, and we mustn't overlook that fact. And then the other thing we're reminded of here then is that one aspect of what we are looking forward to as believers is this: reunion. Reunion with other believers. Certainly at the resurrection, and this phrase seems to be indicating even at death, there is reunion. Yes, as Paul puts it, the death of the believer is a departure to be with Christ. And that, of course, is the supremely thrilling thing. But nonetheless, the death of the believer is also this gathering to our people. And that's pretty special too, isn't it? You think of all those dear Christian friends and loved ones that you've had. And those friendships, those bonds have been cruelly severed by death. And you're going to be gathered to those people. People who have been instrumental in your conversion. People who you know prayed for you day in, day out, while they were still alive here on earth. People who sat here with us at NREC Sunday by Sunday. And the world just seems such an emptier place without these people. And this verse is indicating to us that we're going to be reunited with them. And that these years of separation, which can be so painful, they are really just a tiny blip in the grand scheme of things. And they will soon be swallowed up by this wonderful, irreversible, permanent reunion. So Jacob dies at the end of chapter 49. And you'll notice then, moving on, that Joseph's initial response to that is tears. This isn't the first time we've seen Joseph in tears, nor is it the last time we will see Joseph in tears. But his weeping here is a little bit different, isn't it, to the other occasions. These tears of Joseph here, these are tears that all of us can understand. I mean, few of us have ever wept because our brothers who once betrayed us and whom we thought we would never see again have now, 20 years later, unexpectedly turned up and are showing signs of being changed in their characters. Few of us have ever been in that situation and wept because of that in the way that Joseph wept several chapters ago. But many of us can relate to Joseph's tears here now. Many of us have cried over the death of a loved one. And it's interesting, isn't it, that just like ourselves in similar circumstances, weeping is all that Joseph can do in this situation. I mean, think about that. This is the second most important man on the planet. Second only to Pharaoh himself. This is a man who can interpret dreams. This is a man who can single-handedly save the lives of millions of people as 7 terrible years of famine grip the ancient Near East. This is a man who has Pharaoh himself virtually eating out of his hand. This man, he seems to have no limits to his capabilities until, that is, his beloved father lies dead on the bed in front of him. And in that situation, powerful Joseph is as powerless as you and I would be in the same situation. This man can command the highest level of Egypt's civil servants around, and they will meekly obey him. But he can't command his dead father back into the land of the living. And that's why, for all that we rightly admire this man we've been looking at over all these weeks, Joseph, we mustn't place Joseph on too high a pedestal, and we mustn't make too much of a hero of him. And we must be glad that the Bible doesn't stop with Joseph. It doesn't stop at the end of Genesis 50. It doesn't reach its zenith, its highest point with Joseph. No, it goes on and on and on until finally it presents us with someone else whom we also observe on one occasion in the context of a funeral. And this man, like Joseph, weeps, as in his case, a dear friend lies dead. But this man doesn't just weep. Having wept, he then walks to the entrance of his friend's tomb, and this man cries out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And such is the authority and the power of this man, Jesus Christ, that in that moment, death judders into reverse, and Lazarus comes out of the grave. And that incident then in John 11 that all of you know, that incident, it doesn't just put Joseph in the shade, does it? It puts every other hero who has ever walked this earth in the shade. Whoever your heroes are this evening, whether sports stars or film stars or pop stars or whoever they might be, don't put any of them on too high a pedestal. Don't put anyone on too high a pedestal who in the face of death is as helpless as you are. Because the fact is that you're going to die one day. And you need a hero, therefore, who isn't helpless in the face of death like you are. You need a hero who has authority and power in the face of death. A hero who can stand before your grave and command you back out of death again. Don't settle for anything less than that. Don't settle for any hero who can't meet that criterion. Put Jesus Christ on the highest possible pedestal, because he alone meets that criterion. Make him your hero, and you will find that he will come for you the other side of death itself. And he will bring you back out of there, and he will rescue you even from the impenetrable grave. So Joseph's initial response, I'm saying, is tears. But then notice he quickly gets to work, doesn't he, arranging this funeral, this burial trip anyway, to the land of Canaan. And of course he does so because his father has explicitly requested that. He has requested that of his sons generally, and we read that in the last few verses of chapter 49. He requests of them that they bury him not there in Egypt, but rather back in Canaan. But of course, he has requested that more specifically and more bindingly of Joseph himself back in chapter 47. You remember in the last few verses of chapter 47, Joseph was made to swear to Jacob, to put his hand under Jacob's thigh in that solemn oath-swearing ceremony. He was made to swear to Jacob that he would personally ensure his father was buried in Canaan. And that means then that in a very real sense, Joseph's story ends exactly as it began. It ends with him obeying his father. We saw that, didn't we? That's how the Joseph story begins, back in chapter 37. Joseph showing such obedience to his father. His father wants him to go off to check up on the other brothers who are away with the sheep. And remember how Joseph responds in such a compliant and submissive way. "Here I am," he says. "Just send me to do whatever task you want me to do, Father." The Joseph story begins with Joseph obeying Jacob, and it ends now with Joseph obeying Jacob in these burial arrangements. And of course, in between chapter 37 and now, Joseph's personal circumstances have changed hugely. In the first instance, he's an unheard of teenager. In this second instance, he's the second most important man on the planet. Which surely is a reminder to us that as long as one's parents are still alive, one never goes beyond the sphere of the fifth commandment. And you might become a high flyer like Joseph. And you might leave your parents behind in terms of education and in terms of professional achievements and in terms of economic status and all the rest of it. But you never leave behind the responsibility to honor your father and mother. And then just one last thing on these funeral arrangements then before we move on. This whole business that we have in the first part of chapter 50 of Joseph asking Pharaoh permission to leave Egypt. Does that not sound a bit familiar to us? Is that not a foreshadowing of something that's going to happen later on? Is that not a foreshadowing of Moses asking a different Pharaoh for permission to leave Egypt? And are there not other touches as well which connect the two scenes? The mention of chariots, for instance, which have a prominent place here in this funeral procession to Canaan and also in the Exodus there in Moses' time. And so there are these parallels, I think, that we're meant to detect here between Joseph's approach to Pharaoh here and Moses' later approach to a later Pharaoh. And yet, of course, the outcome is so different, isn't it, from these two approaches? I mean, this Pharaoh here, he could hardly be more obliging in the way that he does send his chariots and he sends lots of his servants and he's very happy for Joseph to go and leave and go to Canaan. Whereas, of course, that later Pharaoh, he kept on resisting. No, you can't leave. And then saying, you can leave. And then changing his mind, no, you can't leave. And it makes you think, doesn't it? Would it not have been much easier if God had just made this Israel's official return to the land of Canaan? I mean, they had to return to Canaan at some point. Why couldn't it be now, when things are so smooth? I mean, supposing the family had got there to Canaan and they'd buried Jacob and they just decided, well, perhaps we won't bother going back to Egypt. And okay, we're breaking our word a bit because we've said we will, but we'll just stay here now and settle here again. I mean, that would have just made everything so much smoother, wouldn't it, than that exodus that did eventuate all those centuries later, which required plagues and that hair-raising pursuit by Pharaoh of the Israelites to the Red Sea and all the rest of it. Would it not be easier if this were the official return? Well, yes, it would be easier. It would be smoother. But this is the thing. A straightforward exodus here in Genesis 50 would not bring nearly as much glory to God as that complicated exodus 400 years later did. Remember how in Exodus chapter 9 verse 16 we have those words there of God through Moses addressing Pharaoh. Exodus 9:16. For this purpose I have raised you up. This is God saying to Pharaoh. This is why I've raised you up, Pharaoh. You stubborn, resistant king of Egypt. This is why I've raised you up. To show you my power so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. In other words, this is why there has to be a complicated, messy exodus like this. In order that the earth will hear of this God who sends plagues and parts the Red Sea. And of course the earth did hear. So that you come to the book of Joshua. And there's Rahab the prostitute in Jericho. And she's heard of what happened. The parting of the Red Sea and all the rest of it. This is why it had to be complicated and stressful. I've mentioned already John 11. And the Lazarus narrative there. And doesn't that narrative raise for us a similar question? Would it not have been easier if Jesus had gone straight to Bethany as soon as he heard the report, Lazarus is unwell? Because then, of course, he would have got to Bethany in time to simply perform a healing miracle and make Lazarus better from whatever this illness was that he had. And then there'd have been no death, and there'd have been no mourners had to come, and there'd have been no broken-hearted sisters there in Bethany. Would that not have been easier? Well, yes, it would have been easier. But again, the healing of a poorly Lazarus would not have brought nearly as much glory to Jesus Christ as the raising of a dead Lazarus did. We need to understand this principle then. This is why providence is so often such a white knuckle roller coaster ride for the people of God. Because you see, in any and every situation, God is not looking for the easiest, most straightforward option. No, God is looking for the option that will bring most glory to his name. That's his priority. And providence, therefore, will often be messy and complicated, a painful, stressful business, because that's the priority which in the mind of God is driving everything. What will bring most glory to his name? So that's our first main theme in this passage this evening, Joseph's father's funeral. But then secondly and more briefly, Joseph's brother's fears. Joseph's brother's fears. Because we read then in verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So they are fearful that now Jacob is out of the way, Joseph will get at them for what they did to him. And so you know what they did and how they sent this message to him. We don't know, of course, whether they are being honest, and this is a truthful report of Jacob's words, or whether they're just making this up. But either way, the point is they are greatly fearful. And of course, their fears in and of themselves are perfectly reasonable. Indeed, if Joseph had been thinking in the way that they're worried he might be thinking, Joseph would still be standing on much higher moral ground than they had been standing in on all those years earlier. Because, of course, part of the horror of what they did all those years earlier was their indifference to their father's feelings. I mean, even if they did hate Joseph that much, you'd have thought just a bit of respect for their father's feelings might have stopped them from doing what they did to Joseph. But no, they didn't care about their father's feelings. They just sent this bloodstained robe to Jacob and allowed him to draw those terrible conclusions from it. And so if Joseph then had delayed getting revenge on his brothers out of respect for his father's feelings, he would be standing on higher moral ground than they had been standing on. But of course, what we discover is that he's not thinking in those terms at all. Not at all. These brothers' fears are groundless. Which raises the question then, if Joseph's refusal to exact revenge on his brothers wasn't out of respect for his father's feelings, what was it out of? Why is he so lacking in vengeful impulses? Why doesn't he want to get his own back? Why doesn't he want to settle scores? If it's not to do with his father and that whole side of things, what does lie behind it? Well, as we close, three things. First of all, love. Love. I indicated earlier on that we have one more instance of Joseph weeping. And we have it there, don't we, in verse 17. And so it's when this message comes from them. Please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And you might think, well, isn't that a bit strange? Why is he weeping there? I mean, isn't it good that their consciences are troubled by this terrible thing that they did all those years ago? Well, This is precisely the point, that it was good that they were troubled by their consciences 17 years earlier. Remember when Joseph was still keeping himself hidden from those brothers who have come to Egypt to buy grain? And Joseph wants to check then that they are conscience stricken, and he does all those strange things to test them, to see if their consciences are troubled. And he finds that their consciences are troubled, and that's great, that is a good thing at that point. But the point is that on that basis, on the basis that their consciences are troubled and they seem to be evidencing repentance, Joseph forgives them then. As far as he's concerned, at least, they are forgiven from that point. And what distresses him now then is this discovery 17 years later that these brothers, they're not feeling the benefits of that forgiveness, which he in fact has extended to them. They're not enjoying it. They're not comforted by it. They don't feel fully forgiven. He has fully forgiven them, but they don't feel fully forgiven. So yes, Joseph was pleased to discover their consciences being troubled 17 years earlier, but then he forgave them. Now, 17 years later, he's appalled to find that their consciences are still troubling them, even though they've been forgiven. And I'm saying then that the fact that distresses Joseph so much, doesn't it demonstrate love in Joseph for these brothers? I wonder if we were in Joseph's situation here, would we weep at this point? As we receive this message and we realise that the brothers, they're really scared and they don't know where they stand with you. Would we respond as Joseph responds here? Would we weep at that? Or would we rub our hands with glee and feel, well, this is the best possible outcome. I've got the best of both worlds here. I take the credit for having forgiven them, but they're still, you know, properly feeling some discomfort for all that terrible thing they did to me. This is great. We might feel like that. But that's not Joseph's attitude, because that's not the loving attitude. You see, love, when you have been wronged by someone and that person has repented of that wrong that they have done you, love is not simply expressing verbal forgiveness. Love is wanting that person to feel that forgiveness in the depths of their heart and wanting that person's conscience to never again be troubled by what they have done to you. That's love. And that's challenging, isn't it? I wonder, is there a situation for you this evening where someone has wronged you and you've extended forgiveness to that person, but you perhaps could have tried harder and could be trying harder to assure that person that they really are forgiven? And that you have nothing against them. As I said before, we perhaps, in our perverseness, sometimes derive satisfaction from the thought that someone feels discomfort because of a wrong they've done to us, which verbally, ostensibly, we've forgiven. And that should not be. Love means wanting the person who has wronged you and repented to be utterly assured of your forgiveness. So love, that's one reason Joseph hasn't exacted revenge. Number two, humility. Humility, those fascinating words in verse 19. Do not fear, he says to them, am I in the place of God? You see what he's saying there? He's saying, look, even if I wanted to exact revenge, I'm just not entitled to do so. It's not within my remit. It's not appropriate for me. I don't have the right to do that. We talked this morning about one aspect of humanness being that you only die once. And Joseph is saying that another aspect of humanness is that righting wrongs done to you is not your prerogative. It's not your responsibility. It's not your remit. It's God's. And yes, of course, that is nuanced in the sense that God does delegate to authorities, to governors, to states, the responsibility to enforce and implement justice. But in terms of individuals, in relation to private wrongs done to them, Joseph's principle here stands, that we just don't have the right to seek to right the wrongs done to us by exacting revenge, seeking to settle scores, get the person back. An eye for an eye. That's a great principle at the level of the authorities that God has instituted, but not for the individual in the case of private wrongs. And so I'm saying that Joseph here, he displays great humility, recognizing that he's not God. Which was quite something for the second most important man on the planet to recognize. In a land where great rulers were virtually deified. And Joseph here is quite open, look, I'm just a man, I'm not God, and I don't have the right to get you brothers back for what you did to me. And it reminds us then that when you and I fail to treat properly someone who has wronged us, it's not merely a failure of self-control, it's a failure of humility as well. We're being arrogant, we're being proud, we're thinking that we're something that we're not, we're being too big for our boots, we're arrogating to ourselves prerogatives that belong to God alone. So why doesn't Joseph seek revenge? Because of love, because of humility, and then thirdly, because of understanding. Understanding. Those great words in verse 20, which for many kind of sum up the whole of the Joseph story. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. And we don't need to linger over these words because we've seen similar words earlier on in the narrative, and we've talked about those, and we've talked about this principle often in the series of God overruling evil for good. But we haven't yet related this, as it's related here, to how we view then those who have wronged us. And this is important because if then we feel that this person who has wronged us, if we feel that person by their action has just wreaked unqualified havoc and there's nothing really more to say than that, they've simply been destructive and damaging in what they've done, end of, then it's not going to be very easy for us to avoid bitterness. But if we understand that actually that person's wrong action, well, yes, not condonable, that person's wrong action must have been in the mind of God for a good purpose, then it makes it easier, doesn't it, to escape bitterness and to be forgiving in the way that Joseph is here. This is another dimension to the peace of mind that the belief in a sovereign God brings to us. Belief in a sovereign God brings peace of mind at so many levels, doesn't it? Just watching the news and seeing how messed up the world is, and we can keep saying to ourselves, it's okay. Yes, we should. At one level, we should lament all the mess of this world, but at another level, at the ultimate level, it's okay. God is in control. He's overruling all of this for his own purposes. It brings us peace of mind at that level, just viewing the messiness of the world around us. But when we come closer to home, it even should give us peace of mind in terms of the wrongs that others have done to us, because we know that those wrongs are somehow within the plan and purpose of God and must yield good. So, Joseph then, such a wonderful example in the way that he treats these brothers. No interest in revenge. Whether his father's alive or dead, no interest in revenge. Because of his love, because of his humility, and because of his understanding. And just one final touch. Again, let's return to those words in verse 19. Am I in the place of God? And we said then that's wonderful humility that Joseph is demonstrating there. But is it not the case that there is also something a little ominous about those words? Joseph is assuming something, isn't he, there? He's saying that, no, I'm not going to right this wrong you've done to me because I'm not God. But he's assuming there that God must address wrong. God must deal with sin. I can't because I'm just Joseph. But God must. And he must indeed, and he does, and he will. Because God is a God of comprehensive justice. And it's great then when you have wronged someone and that person treats you in the way that Joseph treats his brothers here. But that treatment by the person we've wronged mustn't ever lull us into a false sense of security and make us think that that wrong we've done has just been kind of obliterated and no longer matters at the ultimate level. Because at the end of the day, there is a God in heaven who cannot overlook wrongs. His justice means that every sin must be dealt with. And it must be dealt with in one of two ways. Through one of two eruptions of divine punishment. Either the great one that is coming at the end of time, or the one that took place at Calvary 2,000 years ago. Sins can't just drift into the ether. They must be dealt with by this just God, either on the last day or on that Good Friday at Calvary. What about your sins? How will they be dealt with? Are they still outstanding? Are they still undealt with? So that you will suffer God's punishment forever when that last day of judgment comes? Or can you say, because I'm trusting in Jesus Christ this evening, I know my sins were dealt with fully and completely, as we saw this morning, in that outpouring of divine justice on Jesus at Calvary. Make sure that it's the latter. Make sure that you're trusting this evening in the substitute, Jesus Christ. Amen.